largely affected his argument on the level of the capacity to engage in extreme medical responses to minor conditions. But the key thing that matters in terms of the structure I'm trying to set out here today is that he said it's not a good idea. What he did was he made the distinction between Tzoreh and Tzar. Right, that was his big distinction. And then he managed to formalize that by claiming that we know that Tzar is always built in Drabban, so what you can make this Drabban that compels you to believe that there is a difference between Tzoreh and Tzar. As he was not compelled to make distinctions among Tzorahim, he just said the difference between Tzoreh and Tzar. But following that, we went to Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe said that Rav Moshe did not necessarily, didn't really even take much account of the position that Tzoreh had, I don't think. And then he doesn't want to make distinctions between big Tzoreh and little Tzoreh, so Rav Moshe engaged in a very strong effort to distinguish between different kinds of Tzar as opposed to different kinds of Tzoreh. He ended up saying certain kinds of tzara were sufficient to accomplish tzara. We went through the Rav Moshe's attempt to do that. The last thing I wanted to do, Rav Moshe, just to mention offhand, which we didn't see in the end, is that the last paragraph of Rav Moshe brings a really interesting raya from Koros, and I'm interested in why that raya is the end of the Shiva. The minor thing that actually looks like a great raya.
You looked it up.
Yeah.
And you can't do anything to the bone.
You can't do anything to the bone.
So if you're talking about nose jobs or anything like that, no.
That's true. It's not a great riot, but it's kind of cutting an extra growth off your body. Right? Which is sort of like an extra finger. But if you cut off the bone, then your puzzle is a kahuna. Right? But there's blood, presumably. So why would you care about bone or not bone? Right? You're allowed to cut off the extra finger even though there's blood on it, presumably.
Meaning like a fighter, or a six finger.
Extra finger. So I agree that you know that the case there is in bone, but it says extra finger, and the Mishnah doesn't say ina rashai, and Rav Moshe is correct that the Gemara doesn't quote this as being fully on Rav Akiva that says ina dam rashai lachol ba'atmo. So it's really, I don't know. I encourage you to look at it again at some point and say to yourself, wow, there must be a reason, with apologies to Ariel from yesterday, I do give Rav Moshe credit. If there's something that's obvious, Rav Moshe should see it. And therefore, if Rav Moshe only throws this in as a throwaway at the end of his tshuva, there must be an easy way to dispose of it, but I haven't seen it. I think I thought it was a really great ride. Before I build my own truth around it, it'd be nice if somebody figured out for sure about why it's not a good riot. Okay, then we go to the Mincha Shlomo, and Shlomo Zalman, who really just says straightforwardly that there is no reason to ban plastic surgery in terms of Kabbalah. He has in this particular case involved, he has issues of Yilbash Gebra Sim Latisha. That's why he worries about halacha, but his basic line about this is about the kiyak. Ulama Yisur shall kovel begufo and nirat lo shaya hafa kevin the sikra to esko. End discussion. And there's no kavala, if it's a sikra. And plastic surgery, plastic surgery for beauty, makes it a sikra, which sounds like Rashnal Zalman has about as broad a notion of kovalit as you can come up with. Right? You can engage with Kabbalah Asmacha so long as it ends up being a secret.
I mean,
yeah.
More than that, it's not Toelet, it's not an external Toelet. This very thing that I'm mahaveling is, in fact, a Toelet itself. It's not like I'm going to be Hovel here and then somewhere else I'll be some Toelet. I'll get money, I'll do this or that. It's a Toelet Begufa.
Okay, good. That's right. So here's the point here. I'm going to go back to an axis that I think. It doesn't seem like anyone else is paying attention to it, but I'm going to harp on it, which is the question of whether there's a difference between Kabbalah and Tzara. times, right? So in terms of tsar, the Rav Moshe sets up this calculation that tsar is opposed to reva. Right? In terms of Kabbalah, so Roy wants to argue that the equivalent that in order to be matir Kabbalah, it's not enough to gain more than you lose. The gain has to be intrinsic to the body. It couldn't be gufo. Right? So the question is, right, is that really separable that way? We say, well, the Kabbalah is only mutter for tikkun de guf, and tsar is mutter for overall reva. Or do we say that, look, tsar and Kabbalah are the same iser? How can it be that the same purpose is not sufficient? This is the same issue that we talked about, that this is the reverse issue of the Chalkos Yaakov, who is not your sakana to remove tsar, right, as opposed to improve bodily health. Right? So I think that this is an area where, from the very beginning, right, the very beginning of Dr. Steinberg quoting the Shulchan Aruch HaRav to say that an obligation to create health, so the Shulchan Aruch HaRav only talks about an obligation to avoid tsar. Right? So I think from the very beginning there has been an analytic failure in the treatment of this issue, right, there has not been a sufficient capacity to ground and then explore the distinction between tsar and health, and that's why I think we can contribute, because I just really think it has to be done. I point that over and over again, that people keep conflating them. I think Roy is absolutely right that Shlomo Zalman does not say it as broadly as I do. He just says, Kavish Nesh Dash and Tinkun to West Low, and the Tinkun can certainly be limited reasonably to a Tinkun to West Low. But I don't know that it's halachic to accomplish that. Right? Why should it make a difference between there and Nisayon? Not there and I don't see. You can try, but I think a creative formulation is full for accomplishment.
Do you assume he's working with the Rambams?
If he's not, then what is he doing? What is he working with? He could be working with Rashi.
Okay.
Right, not learning after Kamocha. So again, how does that let you distinguish between Guf and not Guf?
I mean, I guess...
I think his whole point is that it's not, you're never actually doing Kavala. But Kavala would be some sort of damage.
Right. Kavala is a damage to the body.
Because
this isn't the Kavala Shelo Biderech Nitzayon. It's not a Kavala.
Right, that's
Kavala is, yeah. Kavala is damaging the body.
Right, that was my argument. But the tikkun is where you are doing, you know, this temporary Kavala, that will be the tikkun.
This is an interesting notion, right? Temporary Kavala. Right. As opposed to, right, you could try an evasive by claiming that as opposed to viewing this as a temporary Kavala that will eventually lead to a tikkun, we look at this as a single process.
Right.
And that, you know, that you spend several hours wrapped in bandages so that, you know, the nose cut open. We weren't chobal even. We were just engaged in a long process of tikkun.
Right.
That's an interesting thing. Now we can test that. What about things that require two-stage operation? There's, you know, several weeks of recovery between the first and second stage.
So long,
one long process of Kabbalah, right?
What about things like Kalkal and Nazi's
notes?
Yeah, so I mean, those are issues about how, right, the Terrell Mount Lee's notes, right? There are issues about how long we're willing to...
Can we re-break the vote in order to set it?
Yeah. Okay, maybe that's the end. Does it matter how much of a secret in the end? Perhaps not. Right, that might be the standard. Okay, good. And the Shlomo Zalman is short and cryptic. I wouldn't help Ron to put that way. Now, Rav Avadia comes along. Rav Avadia does, just the fun of it, Rav Avadia does exactly what Rav Moshe said, but not Macho, which is the same thing, Sarah Gol and Sarah Katan. Right? He doesn't see this as Dopey Gol. Right? Why can't we distinguish between Sarah Gol and Sarah Katan? Right? And that's. Right, essentially, Rav Avadia has two moves, right? The first one is the distinction between Sarah Gadol and Sarah Katan.
Well, not Sarah Gadol and Sarah Katan, between the Tepe Shoah.
Pardon?
He does it between the Tepe Shoah.
He does it, right, between the two types of Sarah. Okay, well,
yeah, not Sarah Gadol and Sarah Katan, Sarah Mamon versus Sarah.
Doesn't he say explicitly that the distinction between Sarah Gadol and Sarah Katan?
I thought, I was on Sarah Gadol. And I thought it was only Sarah Mamon and Sarah.
All right, let's take a look.
יש לחלק מצורך לצורך ולא כולו בחד המחת המחתים.
What line are we on?
It's paragraph.
אגב, על פי שאת הוספו בבעל
השמיים. Right, it says, okay, right? מכל מקום יש לחלק בין צורך לצורך, ולא long and short, right? The whole shekhan is just, do you think it's finished in tight and not just between?
I think because he gives us a Tosfot of Shaselech Bol Batzvo Kedei Laviach Mamon, and this is not, and he says this is about Tzah and not Mamon.
When you start such a thing, it's not Kavalah. It's not Kavalah because you're helped, because you know it's short, doesn't hurt a lot.
She wants it a lot, she's making it better for her. Why not this be Kavalah?
That's his first move.
Then we start talking about Torah.
The second move is the Rambam, right? He moves from Tosfos to Rambam, you know? Right, when he says that's in the Rambam. When he does Derech Nitzayon. But in Tosfos, right, it's on the Tzorach, he just says, the Chalik and Tzorach, let's put it at the bottom of the Lamad and the Machtino. Alright, you're right, he doesn't use the word Tzorach at all throughout the time.
I don't know where he got the Piskei Tosfos from,
yeah,
but it's clear that Tosfos, if he's bringing that to show that this is what the Tzorach are talking about.
And he says, Mikol Mokum, despite what they say, we don't even need this, because we can come in to say, Yishchog ben Torah HaTorah, right? Like, he says Torah HaTorah specifically as, like, a alternative to the distinction of Mamun and Torah.
Could be, I'm not sure if
it is
that way. I don't think everything's that way. But in principle, I think I agree. Okay. So really what I want to get at about it is that, right, is that first move, which is that, and then again, basically what everybody does is they work on the assumption that that Tosfot can't just mean the Torah. That's what I wanted, like, if you wanted to pick the Archimedean point that everyone sets out from, it's that nobody believes that Kabbalah is an absolute issue. Right. Nobody believes that Tosfos means to say that Kabbalah is an absolute yisur. They all believe that there have to be some circumstances, some purposes for which Kabbalah is mutter. The only question remains is, right, if you follow like Tosfos, then you have to, right, if you follow Tosfos, you have to believe that there are also some purposes for which it's still mutter. And now the only challenge is to figure out which is which. And then if you have a really commitment to conceptual analysis, you'll try and come up with a bright line. And if you don't have such a commitment to conceptual analysis, you'll just come up with a series of problems. Yes, you do.
Maybe I was
Okay. Now Ravadi comes up, right? So I wanna bring that, right? These are two points I wanna bring out methodologically. The first is that notion that when you have a series of posts, you know, approaching the same shaila and reaching the same conclusion, all of whom using different means, then what you know is that the conclusion is inviolate. So if you come up with a reading of the sugya that yields a different result, right? It's not just that you're disagreeing with the reading of the sugya, it's that you're disagreeing with a consensus position that this result has to be achieved. Right? Ironically, right, there's a sense in which if everybody reaches the same conclusion by the same means, that tells you that they find the analysis compelling, but not necessarily the conclusion. If everyone reaches the same result by different means, that tells you that they find the result compelling, although not necessarily the analysis. So ironically, the specific result is, I think, much more powerfully rooted in halakha if you have multiple avenues to it, But the use of that result as precedent for other cases is much more significant if people reach the result in the same way. And because then you understand what the precedent means. Right here, we don't know what the precedent means. We just know that this has to be okay. At least according to those cases. The second issue is I want to point out in terms of methodology is really understanding the difference between believing that the only way to construct the legal system is by drawing right conceptual lines, or alternatively by putting dots on a graph, which can be connected by lines in various ways, and letting somebody else figure out where exactly the lines should be. And recognizing that the lines may not necessarily be straight lines, because there could be other forces impacting on it. If you want a metaphor, you might want to use the orbits, or astronomical orbits, as a metaphor. There are these theoretical orbits, but if you want to know where a planet's going to be, the truth is, lots of different places on its orbit is impacted by coming closer to this body, so it gets pulled out here. It gets pulled out here. It gets pulled out there. Orbits are actually highly irregular because they come into specific circumstances. So you could, right? You can draw the orbit with a nice big bright circle, right, ellipse, right? Or you can say, well, I know that the planet's going to be here. I know the planet's going to be here. And because I know the planet's going to be here and here, so I know that it's roughly going to be traveling along this line. But it's also possible it's going to go like this, right, or like this. Right? There are lots of places, it leaves room. It leaves room for it to navigate around the center point. Right? And another fun metaphor is the central date line, right? Which is a fairly straight line except when it's land masses.
Yeah.
Right? So there's another factor aside from the conceptual coherence, which you might think it should be where the sun is. But another thing is we don't want people to have to change days when they cross their living room. Right? So we move the international date line. Yes, Rob.
Why is it that the halachic international date line has not been a consensus, and you end up with situations of something in Australia and Japan?
Well, that's because we have disputes as to where the disputes were. Why is it a consensus? Because some people think that it has to be bright lines. You have a fight between the bright line people and the point people, right? So then you get a muffle, you get a something, and it works and everything. Okay. There are many, many circumstances. I'll give this speech. There are many, many occasions where the one thing, this is a problem that happens often, right? That you have a machloket, right? But also, let's say when you're choosing electives for courses, right? Or something like that, right? So you put a first choice and a second choice, right? And there might be a situation where there are three courses, let's say, okay? And I think this is number one, you think that's number one, and you think that's number one. But all of us agree that this one is the worst, and this one is the worst, right? We just alternate to which of one and two we put. The three we all agree is the worst. Right? So sometimes, I think often, there are halachic machlokes where the issue is whether the answer to halacha should be A or B. But really, in every case, there are three options. There's A, B, or suffix. And the person who holds A would say A, suffix, B. Those are the possible outcomes. And the person who holds B would say B, suffix, A. But everyone agrees that suffix is the worst possible, the person who holds A holds A, B, suffix, and the person who holds B holds B, A, suffix. Everyone agrees that the worst possible outcome is suffix. And what we do is, we say, oops, we can't decide between A and B, so we end up with the worst possible case. Like, for example, right, whether somebody is a Jew or not. Right, whether somebody is divorced or not. Whether somebody is a mamzer or not. Right, in all those cases, the worst possible scenario is suffix. And everybody would agree it's better to paskin like the other person than end up with a suffix. But we can't make our mind, so we end up with a suffix. Right? Many halachic disasters happen that way. Because we end up creating a situation which is far worse than either of the parties. Each of the original parties would have been happy to concede to the other. If they had known that the alternative was suffix. But I think that this. Right, I think that the. The broad thing to understand is that you always have a choice when you define the halakha. You have a choice as to whether to define it by lines or define it by points. And then you always have the choice, and this again you get from Supreme Court jurisprudence, as to whether to define your precedent broadly or narrowly. Yeah.
Can you make a more concrete example of what do you mean by lines or by points?
So let's say I could tell you that a third arcade, right? I could tell you that when is Kabbalah Mutter? Kabbalah is Mutter, right? Kabbalah is Mutter for a Torah that is entire, right, that is in the body. And Kabbalah is not Mutter for something that is out, for something that is outside the body.
These are points.
Those are, right? No, that's a line.
Oh.
Body, right? The body is now a line. Now, if I thought about it, I might say, you know what? It seems to me that Kabbalah should be mutter for some things that are outside the body. But our Torah can be actually connected to the body, right? For really great, right? For really important Torah, right? I might say, well, you know, and there's some things in the body that I think are not sufficient. Like, I don't think it's permitted to cut off your finger to cure your hangnail. Right? Even though, right, you know, or some other, right? And so there are always going to be cases that test the line on both sides. Right, it might be I'm better. Right, it might be the truth is that, you know what it might be that all I know is this is often an issue in Tosfos. It might be that what I know is that I know that it's mutter to engage in Kabbalah to correct a disfigurement. Okay, I know that I can engage in Kabbalah. I can engage in Kabbalah to correct an ear that hangs down longer than my nose. I can do that. Okay, and I also know that I can cut off my finger on national television for $50. And those things I'm sure about. Now I can take these two points and say, oh look, here's the line, right? I can do Kabbalah for Tikkun HaGuf, but I can't do Kabbalah for Momo. That's a line. But it's not always the case. It might be that I might allow a somewhat lesser Kabbalah than a finger. I might allow cutting myself on national television for $100,000 if I'm broke and otherwise my kids are starving. This will change my life.
Right.
So, that's a hard line to draw. Right. That's a hard line to draw. So maybe all I should say is I know that, right, as opposed to making this rule, I should just say I know that it's usher to cut off your finger on national television for $50. Right. And I know that it's mutter to engage in surgery to correct the ear disfigurement. And there's a whole large area in between about which I know nothing. And I will wait till more poskim, right, reach more cases in which they have clear intuitions about what it's to be. And slowly but surely is the space between the dots will fill up, and the line will look a lot clearer. There's still always the possibility that one particular case will come just between two dots. And right, and a poskim will say, no, here the line should go like this. Always possible. But the odds, right, you know, I would say that the angle at which you deflect it from the orbit, right, you know, the odds of that deflection being correct decrease. Right, you know, decrease in portion inverse proportion of the angle, depending on which side you're looking at the angle from.
So the analogy of Rav Avadia Yosef is more the points.
Rav Avadia Yosef, right, here. Rav Avadia Yosef here is, right, it's just, I don't think that this is a general rule so much. The Rav Avadia gives points from emotion, right, and emotion gives rules. I think Rav Moshe often is the person who does the epicycles. Right, I think Rav Moshe is the one who pulls you out, right, you know, tells you, look, here's the points go up to here, and the points go up to here, but guess what, we're up here right now. right, I think that often is, Rav Moshe often does that. But here, I think that what Rav Avadia is saying is, here he thinks that the category of Torah is not one that is amenable to bright lines. Right? It should be left as an intuitive category. And no, in economy, if you question for 60 cases of plastic surgery, right, you might end up having the points close enough together that there's not so much loss by creating a movie on board yourself. I think it's a choice you always have to give. I say that the methodological issue here is, I think this is often a misunderstanding of Tosfot, and particularly happens when Brisket reads Tosfot. Because what Tosfot often does is, because I have a contradiction. The way to resolve the contradiction is to say that this case is like this, and that case is like that. This and this is that. But what Tosfot will do sometimes is he will give you examples that fall right in the middle of each range. And if you try to define the line based on that, and say that's what Tosfot is asking, that's not necessarily correct. All Tosfos needs to do is be able to tell you there is a way of resolving the contradiction. And if I have one case that is this way, and one case that is that way. So for example, if I have a is I have one sugya that says the Kabbalah Lataras is Asr, and the other sugya that says Kabbalah Lataras is Mutar. And thus it says, Lo Kasha, Ha Bi Kabbalah Lathikun Aguf, right? Kimo Shekabal Bat, right? Kimo Shekhata, Shekhata Espe Yasera. Or in Sharia, Rosh Hashanah says, Ha Bechituch Espe Yasera, and Ha Bar Bachat Moma. It doesn't mean that Tosafot thinks you should draw a bright line. It just means Tosafot says this is not a contradiction, because there are cases where it's mutter and there are cases in which it's asur. And I think that's it's a methodological error to presume that Tosafot is drawing a bright line unless he explicitly formulates it as a bright line. Yes, Tom.
לא ניתן מהפסק הזה אדם נגיד שבאמת יש לו חבלה עצמית שהיא לא ניתוח פלסטי, אבל יש לו איזה צורך מיוחד, אומר שבשום אופן אי אפשר יהיה להשיג את זה מהרוב העניין.
אז אני חושב שאפשר להשיג את זה בחשיבה של אנלוגיה. Which case is most comparable? But that can allow you to consider more than one factor. The limitation of conceptual approaches that they generally only allow you to consider one factor at a time. Is it like that case on this issue? Right, whereas analogic thinking lets you say it's like this case overall, which may involve a constellation of six or seven factors. Okay, it's sloppier, that's the law. It's sloppier, it's less predictable. On the other hand, it allows for a more complex decision. And that, I think, is a choice you have to make over and over again. But, you know, which kind of choice you want. Yes, Rob.
Well, one interesting thing that you have to consider when debating between these two different models is what sort of autonomy you want to give to the person you're giving the task for. If you draw a bright line, then that enables them to make all you give are points, then they're constantly reliant on you for your judgment.
Absolutely. Well, if you don't trust their intuitions at all, right?
Well, if you admit that the system is such that you have this, you know, this wild outlier that could be halfway between both points and all the way up, then you're saying that you can't trust anyone's intuition.
Well, therefore, maybe I shouldn't trust my intuition more than the layperson's if they have enough. They're two separate issues. What's the person who was one of the Mishpat Ivri people? Wrote the handbook on Mishpat Ivri with Moshe Avalos? Is that the right name? I don't know if it's right. There's a Mishpat Ivri workbook by Neil Heft, an Israeli fellow, which he argues rather bizarrely with the least quote from Misha Halakha, that the purpose of the Mishnah giving clear rules is so that lay people can make decisions without rabbis. It's a remarkably tendentious reading. And this quote of Gisha Halakha at the front is really bizarre. It's just like, you know, the quote about he should take the quote of Gisha Halakha loving these broad rules as a statement about the importance of Halakha L'maaseh. and of letting lay people make it, right, it's a wild, wild thing. It makes one distrust the other reading.
And the fact that when you talk to like the Sun, that Mishnah is supposed to like destroy the world.
No, it doesn't put that.
Okay.
It doesn't put that.
No, I'm saying.
All right. But he makes the argument you're making, that the purpose of bright lines is to enable autonomy, ironically, right? Because the more you remove discretion, the more you can trust people.
Right.
Right, there's an interesting irony in there.
Moshe Avalos is a professor of neurophysiology.
No, not the right one. Who is it? It's a workbook. I need to Menachem and somebody. I think it's Moshe. No, this one's by Neil Heft. It's a workbook, but Neil Heft and somebody else, I think. So I'm in town. I'm just about to agree. I don't remember the name. I apologize. I was very mishpat by that. The idea I thought was very clever, even though I thought the reading initial thought was impossible. Okay, that's right. So Ravadia, I think comes up with points, and the points he has is a very interesting combination. It's how much pain you're in, how long the pain lasts, and what kind of gain you get out of it, and how important that gain is. I mean, let's put those right now. Nobody previously has addressed the question of how long the pain lasts. And Ravadi invents this new factor, after all. At any rate, personally, it's a very clever thing. If we're talking about pain, well, what if you put them under anesthesia? Right, that's a very clever move. Nobody, right, nobody previously has thought of evading the Sara thing by suggesting we put a local anesthetic.
So you have to inject the anesthetic.
How much full anesthetic?
Right. So it's pinpricks, you know.
It's full anesthetic.
We'll put a local anesthetic on the place where you then put the. And that's a move you get title points for. You know, saying Sara, what Sara? Now, I don't think it's true at all, because if you come out of surgery, you hurt.
Yeah.
Right? I think it's a sophistic move. It doesn't really work.
But still, the actual action of the surgery isn't.
Yeah, that is a really clever move. What happens? Right? That's what I think is like underlying a really clever move. What happens if you engage in Kavala that will only cause you tsar later? Right? Does that disentangle the right? Well, now we can try to make bright lines. Right? How long does the pain? How long between the Kavala and the pain does it have for us to allow to disassociate them? Ace. Right, you know, we can have all sorts of fun. We can have all sorts of fun creating bright lines to distinguish.
7 days mix up a cool.
And then you're back to not having babies, though.
Right, not having fun because
then in 9 months you're gonna hurt.
This is true.
But that's not hurting. God did that well.
So maybe the epidurals are usser because you're violating Eve's curse.
People argue that. I see
evangelical Protestants argue that. I've never seen a Jew argue that.
But the stupid of Moshe. Can I get a little clash answer from my thinking because I'm going against the curse? And Rav Moshe's like, what?
this is the best.
I think there's still plenty of
pain. Yeah.
Right. This is useful nowadays because people sometimes bring in other elements of the Gemara suggest that there are things about the first night. And the response to that is if you really think that you have to maintain women in these positions because of the curse, then you also have to ban epidurals. And that presumably would cause a white food rebellion. No one has tried that one yet.
I like Rabbi Yehuda Henkin's read that the curse is our roadmap for how to get back to Gan Eden. We have what? Rabbi Yehuda Henkin.
Ah, okay. That's a clever. I don't remember that. Inequality law.
It's inequality law. Yeah.
Ah, that's clever. I don't remember that particular topic. Love the essay. Thank you for reminding me. Okay.
Rabbi Yehoshua that says it?
I think it was actually Rabbi Eliezer.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
Yes.
It's done. So, now the thing I want to get out of the Tisseliezer, though, is that, of course, the Tisseliezer is only opposed to purely cosmetic surgery. Right? He can't evade all the evidence in Tosfos that surgery to remove the womb is purposes of this. Now, of course, a person is made of the womb, and that is the point of the Gadata. A person made of the womb is also made by God. So, right, you're telling the artisan, that's why you made it ugly. I'm not saying the whole model of the pot is ugly, which we do, perhaps if you think in general that people should have two noses, or if you stick rings in your nose, whatever it may be, you know, so we don't object to that. Maybe we think that kind of Kabbalah is much better. No. Yeah.
So isn't the counterpoint to this argument the midrash where Turnus Rufus asked Rabbi Akiva which are nicer, the works of God or the works of men?
The counter was that we eat bread, right? It's Rabbi Akiva saying Turnus Rufus, we eat bread, not wheat germ. Why? Apparently people still eat wheat germ also, but generally we eat bread, not wheat germ. So here's the right. So now, what do we do with this Tzitzel there? Because David is entirely right. There are dueling I got into about this. I think that I'm right to point out that the objection to Tzitzel Yezer raises applies equally to right to movement. The answer is this isn't a good line, right? If you know that you're born with a moon, right? So you fix that moon. You're saying to the Imam, right? Right. But the same token, you know, if you engage in emergency medical surgery, you're telling the Imam the thought you made wasn't strong enough.
אם מסכים פה בהגדות, אז אפשר אפילו הגדה, אם מעשה בשר ודם נעים ממעשה קדוש ברוך הוא, שזה הברית מילה.
זה מה
I don't think this is the. I don't think that's the Tzitzel's main argument, though.
Yeah.
That's just like an extra thing he gives, you know. After he gives his main, the main argument is the argument that he brings from the Shuta. What is it, Shari Tzedek?
Ah, good.
Which is, you know, you don't go, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, or something like that, you know.
Now, the fun thing is, everyone knows that Shari Tzedek is wrong. Nobody thinks we pass like this, right? That's the amazing thing, right?
He
calls the Shari Tzedek.
And he tells me he was wrong. He said he's wrong.
Right, why is he wrong?
Well, let me stabil that it can't... it can't be on pregnant women!
No, he uses testicles.
Yeah.
He uses that the world is given so that we can populate it,
uh-huh.
and it's also not allowing the man to fulfill his obligation of Truvu, and you shouldn't make the men go out and find other wives because they already dabak kibbutz
ha'achat. Uh-huh. So a single woman cannot have this operation.
You might be able to say that from his.
The Shari Tzedek says that it should be usher to go for fertility treatment, for surgical correction of the obstruction of fallopian tubes or anything like that, because you're not sick. And the whole hechter, rafay yirafay, only applies if you're sick. But if you're perfectly healthy. But the same token, it seems to imply you should not be able to go for preventive medicine either. Right? So preventive surgery certainly should be usher also. Because, right, why should you not sick yet? Where does rafay yirafay come from?
He doesn't make it. Most of the argument throughout is about how you should go to Tafis, even if it's not, if it's even close enough to Tafis, not necessarily on the Sabbath. That's most of his argument throughout the Tshuva.
Most of the Sisi Leander's argument.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not the Shari Tzedek.
Oh, okay.
Shari Tzedek just says that Rabbi Rafe, who said? I didn't really write. Sure, good. So we can try to, right, we can say that the Shari Tzedek is wrong because, not because he's wrong in concept, but because his definition of illness is too narrow. We can try that. But I just want to point, so let's point out that what the both Ravadia and the Sicilian Charles premise is that conclusion, the conclusion that women can't get fertility treatment is wrong. And now the only discussion is, does that teach us that, in fact, women's rapport of pay does not apply only to illness? Or does it teach us that our previous conception of illness is too narrow? And then we can try and figure it out, well, now that we've broadened our conception of illness, what happens if, for example, you discover I can't dunk? I take a basketball, jump in the air, and hold it. Right? Now, this has serious consequences on my economic capacity. I can make lots more money. It also, I should say honestly, restricts my enjoyment of life. Right? It's bad for my egos because I look at other people doing this and I say, I wish I could do that. It makes me think badly of my creator, right? Why did he create these other people, you know, who don't learn Torah? Why should they be able to do what I can? And all of that, it's not only a question of dunking. It happens that anyone who's played basketball with me is that, you know, that I am really, really good at taking skydives. This is my shot. And if I were 7 foot 2, I would be, you know, I think I would be, you know, almost as good as Trinidad Bar was. So, you know, I should be able to stretch myself. Right? Because, like, right, so I don't know how you draw the line.
Inakinari,
right? So we can claim, so our point is that if Adi is right, that we want to redefine barrenness as a medical condition, right, such that you get Rafa Yerafe, so now you have to figure out where you draw the line.
I mean,
it might be intuitively that you think that height is one of those things that you're not on them. But let's be careful. What kind of height? Because we have a condition called dwarfism now, which we treat with injections from the pituitary hormone, right?
They often also break bones to allow them to.
Bones to grow, right? So we right now in America we pathologize a certain kind of birth. Right? We think that people who grow up below a certain height are in fact sick, and we give them medical treatment. So now why we draw the line that people who are less than 4 foot 2, right, can be treated medically, but people who are 5 foot 9, right, we can't.
Medically.
Yes, right.
I mean, what we consider disease is associated. I mean, it changes from time to time. There is the medical handbook that, you know, that tells you what are the diseases and what are not. There's certain things that used to be diseases that aren't there anymore. There's certain things that never used to be diseases that now are there. So maybe that's just what we go by. What society considers to be disease, or, you know, that's
not
something.
So
that's
not a very useful category.
But does anyone in society consider having a bad looking nose a disease?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure there are insurance companies that depends on how
we categorize certain things as a moom. Right? A moom is the definition of an aesthetic disease.
Right.
So if your eyebrows are too hairy.
Yeah.
This is one of the writers that we didn't mention, but Rav Avadya brings, you know, the Mishnah Halachos argument is like from the Gemara Ksubos, and that's a moom, and it calls it ripui.
Yeah.
That's just you know.
Yeah. I usually try to avoid
quoting Mishnah Halakha.
But Rabbi Yakov
Chimir.
He does. But I skipped that part.
That's your reply.
You could also say, why does it need to be Ripui altogether? Why do we need to draw a line? Why can't you just say anything that makes you better? You know, it's Rishut to do.
Well, what's his name again?
Well, so then if you have an anorexic person who wants to, you know, get a liposuction because he feels he's fat, he must use.
No, so you can have a societally defined definition of what's better than what's better, but that doesn't mean you can have a societally defined definition of what's a disease.
Oh, I have an interesting issue that can we resist it? Like we tend to think right now that society's definition of certain kinds of femininity is pathological, right? In terms of thinness specifically. So can a post-it get up and say, no, I think this is us, because even though it is a societal norm, right, it's pathological, or are we just defining it as a pathological norm? Again, these are all fair questions, which, again, it's probably better to resolve these just by saying there's certain things we know, and there's certain things we don't know, and we can't really draw a line yet because it's not all fair with what happens in engineering issues. Yes?
Yeah, well, I think the Shari Tzedek tradition, just about roughly your faith, is based on just a limited understanding of what the Hava Amina was.
Yeah.
In other words, he's understanding that the Hava Amina was that it would be osur to heal people, meaning that the act of a medical procedure is an osur act, and in certain specific situations where there's a moom, like there's a maka, that general isur is then permitted. But there's a totally different way to understand Rav Yerafe, which is that the Hava Amina is that I might think that a person healing another person, as opposed to God healing another person, is a lack of faith because Ani Hashem Rof Echa, Kamash Malan, that what doctors do is not a lack of faith. Ani Hashem Rof Echa doesn't mean that doctors can't do medical procedures. So if you understand the Hefter of Rav Yerafe that way, so it doesn't matter whether something is considered a moon, not considered a moon, because Rav Yerafe is not a limited heter in a world of is. Rafo Yerapei means that doctors have permission to do what doctors do.
I agree. Right? That you could have a totally different perception and say that there's no. So we just, you know, that if you have the guy said about David and Ron having mind, you just think that Rabbeinu Pei is teaching you that moral, that human beings should never be constrained in their actions by a prior assumption that everything God created is perfect. And that's a broad theological claim. Right? So we start off with a presumption that everything God created is perfect, and therefore all deviations from natural order need to be justified. And we start with the presumption that God deliberately created an imperfect world, right? And so we should be seeking out relationship opportunities to improve God's creation. Right? Those two perspectives can give you a totally different perspective on medicine and economics. And those are not debatable presumptions halakhically, even though they will, right, I think it's exactly the point, they will generate very different halakhot. Not that you can always say anybody who holds this will hold this, and anybody who holds that will hold that, but you can say somebody who holds this is much more likely to hold that, and somebody who holds this is much more likely to hold that. I think absolutely right. Yes, David.
With deference to Rabbi Akiva and the Agadah I recently quoted, I have a pasuk against him. Hatsur Tamim Paolo.
Yeah, so then we just get into a semantic debate about whether the capacity for growth is an element of perfection. Whether perfection is a self-defeating category, because static perfection is a self-defeating category, then we go to the focus of whether God can transcend logic and create the perfect thing that is nonetheless perfectible or not. We want to have fun.
Okay.
Yes, right.
אני פתחתי את השערי צדק במקור התקשובה כדי לראות את הגישה הכללית אז המוחזק אצלו שאין לסמוך על רופאים ושהסיבה היחידה שסומכים על רופאים בגלל שזה ספק פיקוח נפש אז מכילים לסמוך על רופאים אז כאילו
אנחנו קוראים
מה?
אנחנו קוראים ויכוח אחרי לא?
I think that Sicilyezer has a modified version of that. Sicilyezer has great confidence in medicine, but he still retains that notion. Although I would put this together, here somebody wants a paper, when we did the end-of-life issues. So we, one of the tshuvot that had tremendous impact on end-of-life issues is a Tzitz Eliezer which has this entirely invented notion at the end, but it's what the right thing she says, is that removal of respirators is permitted, because if you don't do this, right, what happens is you have this person who becomes just a goof, with tubes coming out of him, she'avad kimat kol telam elikim shol.
גם תיתן לי איזה מי שפסק שאפשר לחייב אדם להתאפל חלק את זה, אני מדגיש את החיוב בספואה, זה מוזר שבכלל...
So he has a very complicated, and it seems like a very complicated theology, because, right, because on the one hand, right, so on the one hand, he's, right, he has this, on the other hand, he has this notion that the Talmud Elohim is very much physical, right, he also has to put it together his position about abortion, right, where he thinks abortion is only the Rabban, where he passed him like the Rabban, consistently. So Sicily Ezra has a, right, I suspect that you could work out a quite consistent...
And he thinks organ donation is usher.
I suspect, but then they all tie into some kind of conception of what the human body is. Right, that would be my sense that Sicily Ezra has a very complex but understandable conception of humanity, and I just haven't seen a paper on it. There's room for an overall paper. Particularly as a conception of what it means to be a body and have a goof. I've seen enough, you know, just those three places which I know, end of life issues, abortion, and here, they all come from a very deep set of assumptions. But I haven't done the work. I don't know if this is really going to work well enough at all. I think somebody should be writing that. Somebody comment. Okay. There should be a real impact on you as to whether you find the Shaar HaTzedek completely out of hand. And even the Tzitz Eliezer's modified Shaar HaTzedek, like, where is he coming from? You know, we all know that they came about Brit Milah, so, right, you know, that Brit Milah is our precedent. We engage in surgery for the Torah. End discussion.
Or Brit Milah is a Kiddush.
Or really, well, Rakiva doesn't have Rakiva, takes it as a paradigm. I think we could do that. I think I tend to come there. I quote that a lot more often than I quote the story about the ugly man. But if you, you know, even though, you know, Ishai Gaffney saw that story years ago and, you know, it had a tremendous impression on me. But if you happen to be the person for whom the Rabbi Akiva story is always a source of amazement, how can you say that? Right? Obviously, the only reason we can do Brit Milah is because God told us to specifically. Right? God told us, you know, God told us, we have a heter for bread. But nobody said anything about omelets. Who says omelets are raw egg, and that's it. Right? So you have that kind of perspective, right? That every new food needs to be justified. Right? Then you'll tell the difference. Okay, one word of caution. I just recognized that when I was talking with Chacham Greenberg the other day, so we were engaging in competing with Dr. Yohan, sort of, you know, just taking everyone's argument, and the point I made an argument with him, which I think is relevant to say, is that, but I think it's nogeya to the way I give shir, is that any idea can be reduced to absurdity, certainly any conceptual idea. So you should not reject an idea because I can get you to laugh at it in shir, because it's just a technique. One can take any idea. Every rule will have absurd consequences. The issue is, right, when you formulate a rule, you have to decide, first of all, which is more of a value, clarity or the avoidance of absurdity. Right, and secondly, which consequences am I prepared to live with, and which consequences am I going to trust people to find ways around? Right, so that I use as a standard pedagogic technique taking any idea and pushing it to its extreme and showing that its extreme is absurd does not mean that the idea is wrong. It just means that you have to be aware of what the consequences of that idea are. But every idea has absurd consequences. Right, that reminds me, because I know, like, for some reason Shira has been funnier this year, I think it's been several years. And, you know, people are quick, and so you pick up when an idea is being pushed to absurdity, and I don't want you to think that just because I pushed it that way, that means I think it's wrong. Means I think is that you have to understand that's where that idea could lead, and you have the responsibility to either accept those consequences or to put in some kind of tripwire so before you get to that absurdity, you're not going to get there. Right, there's some thing which tells you here you should take an appetite. Yes, Ralph.
What about the idea that one should avoid all ideas that lead to absurd consequences?
Yeah, that one too.
That one has absurd consequences.
Yeah, that has absurd consequences.
Yeah, the absurd consequence then is that you should avoid all ideas.
Okay, that's the end of the end of plastic surgery. I want to move now to optics. Ambiguous. All the Rashba says is that just because a person writes Sheba Nechasav, Sheba Asmo Nechasav, doesn't mean he means it. Right, so Rashba is way out of the question of whether you can engage in gender slavery, is that you don't actually have consent.
Well, that's what both him and the vote are consistent with the opinion team on Pelotonic Gemma.
Sure. As they should be.
No, but that's the way I think.
Right.
I mean,
so the question is, can you make the deal and say that since he takes this way out, he doesn't say that it wouldn't be foul if he did agree to it?
Yeah.
That it would. I'm not sure that it's true.
But he says it in his payment as well, that you can be mochel on Tzara, it's just he actually has to be mochel on it.
Good. So my question is it necessarily true that the only thing wrong with Abzud is Tzara? Right, so you have to be careful about drawing lines again. Right? Right. It is true that there is a whole list of Rishonim who believe that if we pass them like Rabbi Yochanan, that in fact they have to come to be Kovel, right, for someone else to Kovel you as well. And it is true that confronted by the question, all the Rashba says is that the reason that a shtar which entitles you to enslave me in exchange for a debt is not Kal is because that is not the intent. So you have to be careful about thereby assuming that if you wrote a star the other way, that it would be called. Maybe, you know, sometimes that's the case, and sometimes it just means that he thought you didn't need to get that issue because he had a different way out. That's, you know, always a careful thing in reading Shavuot, that people give all the arguments they can make, they only give what they think is the best argument, so they give them the most meaningful, accessible argument. You know, I can just get rid of your child like this, so I don't need to reach the other issue. if on the other axis, the issue is actually complicated and requires discussion, it's better to just dispose on this axis more straightforward. Okay, so the rush.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
If we're going to keep on relying on Rabbi Yochanan's opinion that, like, we can't always trust people with their answers, then even if we ever conclude that halakha is in line with informed consent, can we ever get informed consent?
Well, I can figure it out. You know, Rabbi Yochanan gives you, you know, common sense rules. Sometimes yes means no, and sometimes no means yes. Right? And then Rishonim try and figure out when does yes mean no and when does no mean yes. And the answer is we could get informed consent for some things, and for other things we would never believe it.
There's certain surgeries that you could never actually get in. So even if we believe that there's autonomy in your right upper own body,
right,
there's certain surgeries we would think no one would ever say.
That's right.
Or no one would ever say no to this because it's so obvious.
That's right. So we declare you incompetent, just like that travel belt.
So then we can never really have a full informed consent the way that we talk about it in.
Well, yeah, you got a full consent, but consent only functions within certain kinds of boundaries. If you say no to this, then we assume you're crazy.
Would it help if we have them do chalipin along with the informed consent?
We don't really. I mean, we can try. You know, so one of the things you can do in practice like this is to require them to fill out the form in triplicate, right, and then to sign it in blood or whatever else, right, whatever else it may be.
Assuming they have permission to draw the blood for that purpose.
this is exactly the biggest trick that I should do. That's exactly the issue, right? That's what I thought the dialogue with Dr. Applegon was really good at bringing out, that even if you have a formal commitment to autonomy, there are still the concern that you're going to do something crazy, right? So somehow we want to find some control. We want to avoid people misunderstanding jokes. We want to avoid fits of craziness. We want to avoid, right? And the way we do that is by saying that certain things are impossible. You could never really have consent to do that.
There's always going to be a limited autonomy that hinges on consent.
A practical limit. That isn't right. We can define it. We can define that practical limit formally by saying that we give complete autonomy to all competent people. Right, but then you get into the catch-22 problem, right?
Because by saying no, you're just pretty incompetent.
Right. You know the original catch-22, right? Is that like so old people don't know what it is anymore?
If you want to fight, you're crazy.
If you want, right, the desire to be discharged as insane is evidence of sanity. And no one can ever be discharged on grounds of insanity, because in order to be discharged, you have to apply, and by applying, you're demonstrating insanity. Right. So that can work in reverse also. Right? The only way you could agree to this. You only agree to this if you're sane, but agreeing to it demonstrates that you're not.
I know, but I remember in the conversation with Dr. Applegon, there was a lot of us that were very uncomfortable with that, because it was never a full...
Sure.
Because you're always going to be stuck in that.
So you might be very uncomfortable with those Rishonim. Or you might say those Rishonim only apply to cases of where he said yes and no in response to a question, but if you wrote it out in his own hand, right, then there's no possibility he's joking, right? You could come up with new distinctions.
Oh, we're sarcastic in voice, but we're not sarcastic in writing?
Yeah, people take it much more seriously, right? You might argue that if he signs under penalty of perjury, right, that's sufficient. Right. There are all sorts of ways in which you could claim that Rabbi Yochanan is limited to situations where the possibility of error is too great, but we can come up with situations where there's no possibility of error.
I guess, yeah, like now no one would ever sign a consent form thinking, like, oh, I was just joking when I signed that.
That's right. So we can
take away Rabbi Yochanan with that.
Yeah.
Okay,
okay, we'll make one word. This is where we start the whole college at the end of the summer. So, to me, we're not going to keep learning this summer, so it's worth mentioning. I always like